Today's guest is a repeater, but it's been a while since I've had him on. He is the longtime curator of the blog Autoculture and the podcast The Liminalist. He is also the author of numerous books, most notably Prisoner of Infinity, Vice Kings, and 16 Maps of Hell, a brilliant examination of Hollywood. Folks, I give you guys the great Jason Horsley. Jason, thank you so much for dropping by today, sir.
Thanks, Stephen.
Okay, folks, this is going to be a good one. As longtime listeners of The Farm are probably aware, Stanley Kubrick is my all-time favorite director. To me, there's Kubrick, there's David Lynch, and there's everybody else, with the possible exception of John Carpenter. Recently, I've had to reconcile my love of Lynch's films with the increasing disillusionment I feel towards David Lynch, the man. Jason, by contrast, has long despised Stanley Kubrick, but has made a game effort to fairly judge what may be the spookiest of directors. And no, I'm not talking about what was allegedly haunting the Overlook. Well, possibly, at least if you subscribe to some of the more fantastical interpretations of Kubrick's version of The Shining. Anyway, throughout his recent work, dubbed the Kubrick Con, Jason has explored many of Kubrick's most suspect connections. But this is only one curious aspect of Kubrick's life and legacy explored in that work, which we'll be considering and debating. Curiously, both Jason and I seem to have come to the conclusion that Kubrick was a psychological warfare specialist of the highest caliber, but we take different views on his motives and loyalties. This will no doubt lead to some fascinating discussions. So, on that note, let us start the show. All right, Jason, let's start off by addressing Kubrick's worldview. He's often depicted as being a strict materialist notion that I have trouble that a notion that I have little trouble rejecting personally. So you seem to stand a bit in the middle. Obviously, there's been a bit reference in terms of Kubrick's esoteric influences, such as the Golden Bow and Jung. But in general, do you subscribe to the notion of him as a materialist, or was that a bit simplistic of a characterization of the director?
Yeah, I think for sure. I mean, to start with just the most basic answer, like nobody is one thing anyway. So we're trying to analyze a human being in terms of their motives, their intentions, their output, their work, everything really. I say we have to allow for at least two levels. One is conscious and the other is unconscious. So that's your most basic thing. Like nobody's 100% materialistic or materialist. They're still going to have these spiritual or religious drives and impulses. But then when it gets more complicated with somebody like Kubrick, I would say any public figure, at least from, I think, your or my conspiratorial point of view, which is that there don't seem to be many, if any, major cultural players who aren't in some way part of social engineering programs, consciously or otherwise. But I'm addressing the conscious aspect where a filmmaker like Kubrick, to the extent that he was consciously involved in psychological operations, it seems unavoidable that he would have a cover personality, let's say, just as all spooks do. And that this would pertain to, I mean, I discovered or they speculated the same thing with Polanski to some degree. Like Polanski always claimed to be a total atheist and to just think that Satanism and witchcraft was just fantasy. And yet, as we know, he did research Rosemary's Baby very thoroughly. And beyond that, it seems as though he perhaps was involved in some sort of satanic practices, although it's pretty hard to gauge where actual satanic ritual ends and just kind of orgiastic Hollywood indulgences begin. But anyway, that's Polanski. So his claim to be an atheist who didn't believe in any of that mumbo jumbo, I'd say, was just cover. My brother was similar in certain ways, I think. He it's also a defense against them. Anyway, with Kubrick, I would say there's got to be two things going on there. And I don't think that they're mutually exclusive, even though they seem like they should be. Because I do think that although Kubrick, I think to some degree Kubrick was quite a materialist in that he believed in technology, and he had a certain reductionism to his approach. I think he had nihilistic tendencies. Certainly he had misanthropic sensibility. His view of mankind seemed to be non-spiritual, let's say. I mean, even literally in terms of 2001, you know, man's just a hairless ape kind of point of view. So all of that seems to be going on consistent with his work and with his public persona and even his private persona, insofar as we can gauge that from family members and stuff. But there's also this other side of him, which is partly visible through his work, but much more visible through a kind of, let's say, conspiracy theorizing around Kubrick, to just keep it simple, but looking into what he seems to be doing, that does seem to overlap with psychological operations, and thereby, if you go deep enough, usually into psychological operations, there's some awareness of occult practices and techniques, such as archetypes, let's say, to use a really easy example. So it seems to me that Kubrick had an awareness of, a respect for, and a use for archetypal knowledge. Now, does that extend to these theories online that Kubrick was part of the cult of Saturn, for example? I think you're aware of that one, and thereby was actually consciously doing films as rituals or whatever. That doesn't necessarily matter, although it's interesting. We know about CIA and MK Ultra, for example, that they certainly use occult principles to fragment psyches and to program alternate personalities. That doesn't mean they actually believe in entities, but they apply those principles. And so it's not clear, it's often not clear, you know, how much a practitioner of occult principles actually believes in them literally. And how much they simply know how to apply them and don't care because they work. So that's what I'd say with Kubrick. It's not entirely clear, but it is clear he wasn't your ordinary materialist. But I don't see any evidence that he was a spiritual man, let's say. I mean, one has to unpack that. Obviously, he wasn't religious, conventionally religious, but I don't find a spiritual dimension to his films, which obviously is a subjective thing. So I do tend to, to see him as a materialist with occultist leanings, let's say, to round it off.
It's interesting you should say that. I would say increasingly as I've gotten older, I do see most of Kubrick's films as being maybe spiritual isn't the best word, metaphysical maybe. There seems to be, I would say, an awareness of magic present in most of them. And I've often, or at least more recently, I've kind of begun to wonder if the image of Kubrick, the materialist, was part of the sleight of hand, if you will, where the audiences are going in here and thinking that they are seeing this purely secular vision coming from this acclaimed director, when in fact it is very much steeped in magical principles, what they're being exposed to. It's, I think, maybe possibly even another way of bypassing the conscious mind, if you will, to implant things into the subconscious. Do you think there's maybe any possibility to something like that being at play?
I mean, that was part of what I was getting at with the MK Ultra analogy also. To me, interest in metaphysical principles and even awareness of them doesn't translate into spiritual. I mean, I use spiritual maybe in a particular sense, as why I juxtapose it with religious, as in equating with an elite, an alignment with goodness and an impetus or an orientation to serve divine principles, which obviously is a religious statement in itself. I don't see evidence of that. And people in Kubrick, and people are certainly artists often, and other operatives, artists and other operatives, often are very aware, as I pointed out, of metaphysical principles. And yeah, I would agree what you're saying, that it's common practice to hide that awareness, because it's a more effective way of applying them. Like if we go in with our eyes wide open, to use play on that film, such as something like Hodorowski, let's say, or even David Lynch to some degree, where the occult elements are really front and center, we're more aware of how the right certain part of our brain is being tweaked and manipulated. Whereas with Kubrick, he seemed to have, in many ways, the opposite approach, which would be consistent with his presenting as a materialist, in that his films were very, they were quite mechanical, and they were very structured, and they didn't really seem to have much of a hidden dimension. It was almost like what you see is what you get with Kubrick. The surfaces were very designed in these very complex and sophisticated ways. But as compared to, say, a David Lynch film, they don't seem to have much unconscious material, bubbling under the surface. Doesn't mean they don't, but just I'm saying that he did approach filmmaking in this way, which seems consistent with him also presenting himself to the world as somebody who was a rationalist. Let's just keep it simple and approach movies like a chess player strategically. And this is a big part of my Kubrickon thesis. It was even the beginning of it, really, was what if, because I want to start a thesis with a question, really, but let's look at, I started looking at Kubrick's movies as if he was not an artist, as in somebody working with his own conscience to try and discover what was going on there, but a scientist, i.e. somebody working with data and with experiment to test hypotheses, right? And so I looked at his films through that lens, and I convinced myself in the end, oh yeah, well, Kubrick, he wasn't making films the way filmmakers usually do, artistic filmmakers. He was making them with a different motive and with a different method. And I've in a number of my books recently, and more and more, I've seen the correlation between science and occultism. It's like they grew up like twins in a way, and they were both in opposition to religion in different ways. But you'll find occultism is imbued through science, and vice versa. You certainly find an attempt at science in occultism. I mean, it's even in Crowley, that principle. So I don't see them as mutually exclusive. Like Kubrick as a scientist versus Kubrick as a metaphysician or an occultist, they seem as two ways of looking at the same character.
One thing I have found just absolutely fascinating in doing a lot of the research on Kubrick that I've been doing for this interview and the presentation I'm going to do for Strange Realities is his whole process to making movies, which I think might be one of the reasons why I actually kind of emphasize with Kubrick, because I find it to be a bit similar to my own creative process. But interestingly, Kubrick really did not do any storyboarding at all for his films, which, for those of you listening to this who don't really follow the ins and out of filmmaking, is fairly incredible. Most directors usually meticulously storyboard scenes before you actually go in and film them, if for no other reason, in the hopes of trying to save on costs so that you don't have to continuously do various takes and so forth. This actually kind of seems to be one of the reasons why Kubrick famously did, 70, 80 takes of various scenes. You have all the accounts of the actors going up to him and asking, "Mr. Kubrick, what do you want from me in this scene?" And basically, they were given no direction. They just kept doing it, 40 or something times until Kubrick was satisfied. But I actually feel like Kubrick, in a lot of these cases, sometimes I think he was doing it for psychological purposes, but I think in a lot of instances, he just really didn't know what he was looking for. I think it was in Baxter's biography, to paraphrase it, where they had noted Kubrick viewed film as basically a construct of different other art forms, i.e., the performance and the writing came from the stage, the visuals came from photography, the music came from opera and that kind of thing, classical. The one unique aspect to filmmaking in Kubrick's mind was editing, which seems to have been the aspect that he really latched onto the most. And this turns up, for instance, a lot with his actors and some of the ongoing disputes, because he would construct performances through the way he edited films that were a lot different. In the case, I think of George C. Scott and Dr. Strangelove and what they were shooting for. So it seems like Kubrick very much saw the post-production is really the time frame when he would actually conceive of the film that he was trying to make, whereas most directors, it seems like, was kind of the opposite. They have a pretty good idea of what they're trying to do beforehand going in. And kind of, I think, parallels what you're saying there a bit with Kubrick wanting to try to look at all these different techniques and so forth. It seems like he imagined almost every scene and different conceptions before he finally decided on how it was going to be played out.
Yeah, be consistent too with the idea that Kubrick didn't really enjoy the unpredictability of human beings or even of life. I mean, that's a bit of a stretch, but it has been said. I mean, there is that view of Kubrick, so I don't necessarily want to reinforce it, but he does seem to have that tendency, I think. And I mean, Hitchcock infamously said actors are cattle, and he had this attitude his actors were just, in objects that he had to manipulate to get the shots he wanted. Hitchcock, I assume, did storyboard. I don't think he was known for doing many, many takes. I think he was a director who did know very much what he wanted and how to get it, as long as the actors cooperated. And that was what he did. Whereas Kubrick, based on what you're saying now, or in reference to that, it seems as though even if he knew what he wanted, because I imagine that the framing, the composition of the shots probably didn't change very much. That would be my guess, even when he did 80 takes. My guess, and I think I've been given this impression too, that he wasn't changing the setup. He was just do another take, do another one, do another one.
Actually, no, he did change the props, and I mean, not always, but there was occasionally like a fixation on, like where may would an ashtray be better in this particular place or another place, or sometimes with the lighting. Yeah, a lot of times though, it was also with the performances, I think.
So some details, and maybe he did move the camera sometimes, but certainly Kubrick, as I've said a number of times, nobody could take away, not even I can take away from Kubrick, his compositional eye. He had an eye for composition. He was an amazing cinematographer, and so I would imagine that that was something, and maybe that even relates to him not needing to storyboard, is that he really had in his head what he wanted visually, but when it came to the performance and the details in the composition, he was fiddling around a lot, doing take after take. And then the net result of that is he does have 80 takes of each shot in a in the editing room, and there, of course, he has total control in a way he doesn't have on the set, because you can't ever have total control over human beings. Not even MK Ultra's managed that quite yet, right?
But
Whereas
with editing, it's just him and like from what I understand, Kubrick actually was the editor on most of his, pretty much all of his movies. The person who got credit as the editor was essentially just his assistant in the process. But yeah, I mean, the whole editing process, it was basically him and maybe one or two other people holed up in his manner for months going over the film. And yeah, he loved that process. That was, I believe, his favorite aspect of a film.
yeah, and that's Kubrick working with objects, with film, with a substance, as I say. So he can, literally a plastic substance back then, he can manipulate it any way he wants. Okay, if he didn't get the take he finds he needs, then he's screwed. But if he did 100 takes, there's a damn good chance he's going to find what he's looking for. And he wouldn't know, of course, because if he knew, he would get it in less than 80 takes. He wouldn't know on set, and you might not even know at the end of that shot. But maybe it's okay, we're going to move on now because my actor's going insane, or he just feels confident that he's covered all the angles. And then perhaps in the editing room, he's watching every take and number down, and then he's beginning to see like what it is that he's shaping. That's speculation, but it seems to make sense. Whether it pertains to what we were talking about before, this Kubrick as a scientist, certainly visually, that's much more the image of a scientist, a guy in a room like a laboratory, frenziedly staying up all night and working with these objects to try and get them to do what he wants them to do, and trial and error, and trying this order and that order, and so on and so forth.
It's kind of funny though, just to allude to why I identify with Kubrick and that, which is why I would argue that there is a creative process to this. It's in a lot of ways similar to how I've always approached writing, be it nonfiction or even fiction. I actually did write several fictional novels when I was younger, though thankfully they will never see the light of day. But
I know the feeling.
I've never outlined anything, even these really complex historical works. Never, ever, ever do an outline. I just start writing effectively. And like Kubrick, I usually go in with firm ideals of different things that I want to touch on and that they're connected. But in a lot of cases, I'm not entirely sure how the connections are all working out and whatnot. So Kubrick seems to have had a similar concept with his films. He had typically, I think, 6 to 8, what he referred to, I think, as non-submersible units. These were the crucial scenes that the entire movie would hedge upon. And he usually had a pretty good idea of what he wanted for those scenes because he would ponder them for years, effectively working with different screenwriters. But it was the scenes that linked them together that he really didn't know what he was looking for. And in my case as well, I almost feel that a lot of times that's what happens to me, where it's like I'm aware that there is a connection, but I haven't explored it to the extent that I would like. And a lot of times that brings to light a lot of things that I had not planned on writing on before. I mean, just, for example, in the case of my most recent book, The Art, I did not go into that with the intention of writing so much about Edward Lansdale. I thought that it would just kind of be a quick, maybe a few paragraphs here or there or something. And then it ended up with essentially two whole chapters almost dedicated to Lansdale. In fact, I would say Lansdale kind of effectively became the protagonist, quote unquote, of the first book, which was never planned in the slightest. It just worked out in the creative process, and it just seemed to be the way to tie everything in it together most effectively. And at least in my own case, I can't help but feel that was, I have no basis for this, but I suspect that this was probably similar to how Kubrick worked and why he did things the way that he did, because I think that for him, the creativity in the editing process was discovering how the scenes that he had spent years meticulously constructing were connected and how to put that together into something that would be a quote unquote coherent film, if you will.
Well, I mean, what you described as your writing process is similar to my own, and I've just had this experience with Big Mother. Like, there's several chapters about serial killers at the end that I really did not intend to include, and I even wonder now if I should have, but I somehow couldn't stop it from happening. So I know what you're talking about, but I absolutely disagree with Kubrick. I just don't think that was going on with him. I mean, we've touched on in the editing room some degree of that. He's trying to discover the exact form. But that very model of five or six non-submersible units, that to me implies an absolutely fixed structure that and a strategy for making movies, which is highly unusual, if not unique to Kubrick. In that essentially, what it infers is he didn't care about the connecting tissue between, as long as it worked, it served as a delivery device the whole film for those five non-submersible units. So then that's entirely different because that doesn't, yeah, he might be looking and having to improvise a little bit to make the connective tissue work well enough so that the overall artifice film serves as a delivery device. Absolutely, it's got to be effective. But it's not like you and I, like suddenly we find ourselves writing about something we didn't expect to because we're following the trail of our own unconscious. I think that that's where I would say it's very different with Kubrick. That his he already had his aim and he already knew what each movie was designed to deliver and why. And so the improvisations were saying, and the slight spontaneity was just dotting the i's, so to speak. It's interesting that we've taken this direction because, I mean, you said at the start, well, you and I see Kubrick very differently in terms of what he was doing and why. And so you're talking about Kubrick now as if he was an artist, and he's an artist that you like, and so on. And the thing is that that's not what the Kubricon's about, right? So it makes me curious. Well, what was it like for you to read the Kubricon? Because I'm essentially presenting a thesis that's incompatible with what you've just described there. Like, my view of Kubrick is that he was making movies with a specific intention, that the intention had nothing to do with art except as a means to an end, and that he was also working with, if not for, others, which to me is inescapable from being a psychological operative. Like, I wouldn't use a psyop for a movie that was trying to manipulate consciousness at an individual level, because that's just art. Like, every art's trying to manipulate consciousness because it's trying to communicate something. But when I talk about psychological operation, that's what I mean, that it's part of a program, and that Kubrick was part of that program. So he wouldn't, in that thesis, he wouldn't have had the freedom that we're talking about, that you and I have. He couldn't just go off the reservation and say, well, actually, I'm going to have these scenes, because the film is already, it's already been established. It's part of maybe why Kubrick took so long over projects, choosing them or having them chosen for him, whichever it was. It's already, once he's actually shooting it, it's already been established what the film has to deliver in, and how it's going to do it, and how it's going to serve as the next brick in the Kubricon, as my thesis has it.
Are you there?
Yeah, you were muted.
Okay. Oh, sorry. Okay, sorry. Did you have anything else you wanted to add there?
No, I had stopped, yeah.
Okay. Sorry about that. Well, I guess maybe we can explore that a little more. I didn't really focus as much on your conception of Kubrick as an artist versus a scientist as much, because to me that's a little more, I guess, subjective of an opinion. I mean, in some extent, I think you could argue that virtually all, I mean, film is certainly anything that's really done through the studio system in a lot of cases is some kind of psychological operation, but especially big tentpole films. But I don't know that that necessarily precludes that there can be an artistic touch that comes in there. And based on my own research, I do think that Kubrick did, if not ever going totally off the reservation, at least did frustrate his backers at times with some of the different works that he did, which we can get into here in a second. But let's get into his spooky background here for a second before we really like delve into this to sort of provide a bit of a foundation. So, as I was telling you here, I'm going to quote from your book, Kubrickon, here between pages, I think 75 and 78. Eight or so, just to get into a little bit of this. So, okay, here we go. Kubrick worked in the early 1950s on miscellaneous television and State Department trivia. He record His second documentary was about a New Mexican priest, Father Fred Strop-Mueller. In 1952, he made a documentary about World Assembly of Youth, an initiative that was to have its payoff in JFK's Peace Corps. His first feature came out in 1953. 3 years earlier, at age 21, Kubrick met Richard D. Is it Rochemont?
I guess so, yeah.
De Rochemont was the younger brother of Louis de Rochemont, creator of the famous March of Time series, cinema newsreels as parodied by Orson Welles and Citizen Kane. Richard de Rochemont worked as a producer on the series and took over as executive producer in 1943. A Harvard graduate and documentary filmmaker, he was associated with General Charles de Gaulle during World War II and wrote reportage. Reportage for Henry Luce's Life magazine, Operation Mockingbird. Kubrick biographer Vincent Labruto writes that Richard de Rochemont was responsible for France's rallying around de Gaulle and against the Vichy government, and that he was highly decorated with honors in the country of his French Huguenot family. Perhaps no surprise then to learn that the older Louis was trained by British intelligence in early 1920s at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology to pioneer naval photography and motion picture reconnaissance. Dwight D. Eisenhower personally recruited him for the position of Secretary of the Navy as World War II broke out. He declined the invitation, requesting instead to serve the country by bringing war to the American people. Lewis also produced Animal Farm, funded by the CIA under Operation Mockingbird, and mediated the relationship between the CIA's E. Howard Hunt and Sonya Blair, George Orwell's widow. According to Lobruto, it was Richard D. Rochemont's support, financial and otherwise, that Kubrick's first film, Fear and Desire, was completed, released, and reviewed, thereby establishing Kubrick as an up-and-coming independent New York filmmaker. De Rochemont was Kubrick's benefactor, boss, and father figure. Kubrick once told Dick's wife, Jane, "You know, we're really Dick's children." The De Rochemont power family, complete with direct links to British intelligence, the CIA, and Operation Mockingbird, put Stanley on the map. Okay, so a few comments on this part here. So you really missed a gold mine here with the World Assembly of Youth. This organization actually was a direct CIA front. Okay, there's like no question about this, that most of the money was coming from the CIA, and at times was actually funneling it through the Ford Foundation, which is also interesting in light of the fact that I believe Kubrick went on to do the what was it, the TV docuseries Lincoln, in the same time frame, I between 1951 and 1953, which was also sponsored by the Ford Foundation. However, we don't actually know definitively if Kubrick worked on this thing for the World Assembly of Youth. What's his name? James Fenwick and Stanley Kubrick produces did an extensive deep dive into this, and he could not find any official records of Kubrick ever being hired by the World Assembly of Youth. However, Kubrick personally was putting this on his CV in the late 1950s, though it never appeared again. So it's interesting, at a minimum, that Kubrick deliberately tried to associate himself with this. And it also doesn't preclude the fact that if he was involved with the World Assembly of, if he was not working on this film about the World Assembly of Youth, he might have been working in some other capacity, because they did like radio programs, all kinds of stuff like that as well, where the records might not be as strong. But I think that that was definitely a crucial thing about Kubrick possibly being brought into some spooky circles early on. And there's another really big thing that happened in this whole period between 1951 and 1953. I'm not going to get into it too much here, because that's one of the big things I'm going to discuss in my Strange Realities presentation. But Kubrick was hired, I think, in 52 to do post-production on a film that, as far as I can tell, has never seen the light of day. And it was written by a former Marine who was widely suspected of being a CIA officer. And even if he was not a CIA officer, there is absolutely no question that his brother was a CIA officer, and an especially notorious CIA officer who has been deeply, deeply implicated in the Kennedy assassination, JFK's assassination specifically. So Kubrick was working for this man in the 50, 52, I think. And it's also interesting to note as well, according to Fenwick, the period between 1951 and 1953 is by far the least chronicled part of Kubrick's life. Pretty much all other phases of his life, he left meticulous notes, references, receipts, all kinds of materials showing what he was up to. But there's been a lot of scarcity around those specific years, and there's been some speculation that a lot of that stuff actually did end up in the shredder.
I should have spoken to you before I released Kubicon, but I think you're just discovering this since, more or less, aren't you? So, but anyway, it was meant to be a short book, so probably just as well
Oh,
I did.
I did, sorry, I didn't mean that to be as a yeah, I didn't mean that necessarily as a criticism. I just was trying to point out some of the other things here with that. All right, so to get back to KubrickCon here to quote from it, Kubrick's pal Alex Singer was drafted in 1953 and posted at the U.S. Army Signal Corps Photographic Center in Paramount's old studio in Astoria, Long Island. Also posted there was James B. Harris, Kubrick's future producer. Harris was a wealthy New York insurance broker who had funded some film distribution deals. Before he went into business with Harris, however, Kubrick made his second feature, Killer's Kiss, in 1955. He was 26 years old, according to the lore, funded the movie with $400,000 borrowed from his uncle, who owned a drugstore in New York. The female star of Killer's Kiss was Irene Kane, who commented that Kubrick is all for sex and sadism. Baxter concurs, it would appear from his films that Kubrick is excited by the image of helpless and sexually threatened women. Following the release of Killer's Kiss, James B. Harris and Kubrick formed a partnership, though they never had any agreement in writing between them. Their first film was the downbeat heist drama, The Killing. The Killing was released in 1956 in June of the same year. Time magazine ran an article titled New Pictures that stated at 27, writer-director Stanley Kubrick in his third full-length picture has shown more audacity with dialogue and camera than Hollywood has seen since the... I can't pronounce that. Orson Welles went riding out of town on an exhibitor's pole. As Libretto describes, the public publicity coup, the ever-elusive king of Hollywood Hills scepter was now in Stanley Kubrick's hands. With his first semi-widespread release, someone might have added courtesy of Lucy's Time Life and CIA's Operation Mockingbird. When Kubrick went to Los Angeles for the film, he met Curtis Harrington and Gavin Lambert, who introduced him to what they regarded as its secret delights, like the home so-called male witch Samson Debrier on Barton Avenue in Hollywood, a mecca of every oddball in the city. This included Ivor Stravinsky, James Dean, and Kenneth Anger, who shot the inauguration of the Pleasure Dome there. According to Baxter, Debrier's home may even have been the model for Quigley's decaying mansion in Lolita. Anger was a Crowleyite with involvement with the darker aspects of occultism and ties to groups like the Process Church, the Manson family, and intelligence programs such as MKUltra. And as striking as his influence on major filmmakers such as Kubrick, Scorsese, and David Lynch. Following The Killing, Kubrick had his first prestige hit with Paths of Glory, which put him into a brief partnership with Kirk Douglas. We'll stop there because the Douglas thing is pretty, which I'll get to in a second. One thing that was interesting about the Samson Debrier thing, and also getting back to Kubrick's uncle, Marvin Persevere, I believe his name was, he's an interesting guy. For those of you, I'm assuming a lot of people listening to this are not familiar with. In fact, just to give a little bit of an illustration here, because I've always found this to be kind of curious, but Kubrick's family had a lot of ties to the medical field. His dad was a doctor, but interestingly, he was a homeopathic physician, which we now kind of think of as alternative medicine. And then conversely, his uncle, Marvin, became quite wealthy, running a chain of pharmacies in California. And he had ended up living in Pasadena in the late 1930s and early 1940s before he relocated to Burbank. So Kubrick is in high school around 1940, and he's intelligent, but he's a poor student, and his parents assume maybe he needs to be challenged or something more, and they send him out to California, where he lives for I think around a year or something like that, like 40, 41, in Pasadena with Uncle Mervin. Well, what's interesting about that time frame is this was sort of the height of the so-called Suicide Squad. That was the group Jack Parsons was involved with that was doing all those testings on rockets before it became Caltech and so forth, and Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And I do believe quite a bit of this was a big sensation of in the surrounding area at the time. And of course, Parsons' family was a society family. And again, Kubrick's uncle was quite wealthy. So I have often wondered if Kubrick might have at least been aware of some of Parsons' activities during this time frame. It's one thing that has never really been investigated, as far as I can tell, but it might indicate that he was intrigued by some of this stuff even sooner. So another thing too that's interesting about the Army Signal Corps, both Singer and James Harris really credited a lot with helping shape them as filmmakers. Harris, of course, later became a director himself. It essentially had a New York studio that they filmed a lot of productions at. From what I gathered, it was very similar to Lookout Mountain in LA, which Dave McGowan writes quite a bit about in Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon. Lookout Mountain was an Air Force base that made a lot of what were sort of described as, I guess, propaganda films or indoctrination films. We really don't know what exactly was being made there, honestly. But the Army had its counterpart with the Army Signal Corps studio in New York, though this was more centered on television than filmmaking. So that's also really interesting in that context, because Singer was the guy who introduced Kubrick to Harris, who was so instrumental in his early career. In fact, Singer was also partly credited with inspiring Kubrick to become a director. So he's, I think, a very crucial player. And in 1960, he landed a gig, I think, working for Leslie Stevens, who was the creator of The Outer Limits. And that definitely opens up a lot of rabbit holes there. But to get back to Kirk Douglas, this is, to me, a really crucial part of Kubrick's development, and especially in terms of his psychological operations work. Douglas was a part of a group of filmmakers that also included actor John Frankenheimer, and director, or excuse me, actor Burt Lancaster and director John Frankenheimer. And they were, of course, there's been a lot written about their attempts to break the blacklist, which actually seems like it was overblown. But these guys were very closely connected to the Kennedy family, the administration. And I have certainly wondered if the Kennedys were partly using them to leak information. So, getting into the second film that Kubrick made with Douglas, which would be Spartacus, this is really interesting because it plays out with, or excuse me, after it was released, it was attacked by a lot of the right-wing press. And specifically, there was a boycott launched by the American Legion, which is a group closely connected to an organization that I'm going to get to here in a second. And on the other side of the coin, Kennedy himself, after being elected the president before assuming office, I believe, personally went to see Spartacus in theaters to lend support to it, which was a big deal back then. The president didn't normally go attend a private screening of a film like that. So it was a very pointed statement on JFK's part. And Kubrick would continue to be working very closely with a lot of Kennedy's supporters through Lolita. I think specifically Shelley Winters actually had to depart the shooting a few times to help support Kennedy during the campaign trail or something like that. But he seems to have been very closely linked to JFK. And in the context of some of the other films that were being made this time frame by other filmmakers, you have John Frankenheimer especially, who did not just The Manchurian Candidate, the original version, but also 7 Days in May, which starred Kirk Douglas and Burt Lancaster, which was about effectively a military coup being launched. In fact, it's actually quite similar to Dr. Strangelove, minus the nuclear component to it. And then also Frankenheimer later did Seconds. And it's my contention that Dr. Strangelove was itself a film that was part of these attempts to leak information by the Kennedy administration in regards to their ongoing conflict with the Pentagon. Just One of the most disturbing things I really sort of learned during a lot of other research related to the Kennedy assassination was that some of the most outlandish lines in Dr. Strangelove, I'm thinking specifically of Turgeson's whole, Mr. President, I'm not saying we won't get our hair mussed, but 10 to 15 million Americans dead at most. It's acceptable loss of human casualties or something. I mean, that's actually almost taken verbatim from something Kennedy was told during one of his meetings with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, where they were trying to talk him into a preemptive strike against the Soviet Union at the end of 1963. And he asked how many casualties we would expect here, even if we caught the Soviets unaware. And they told him something like 30 million, which they considered to be totally acceptable. So it's just, and then on top of that, you have the use of propaganda by the military that's displayed so prominently throughout. And I believe firmly that all of this was parroting what was being done by the Institute for American Strategy. It's a little known group, but it was very crucial in establishing the donor network for a lot of the new right. The Koch brothers, the Richard Mellon Scaife, a lot of people like that were linked either directly or indirectly to the Institute. It was essentially what created the whole concept of fourth generation warfare and a lot of other stuff like that. It became the center of a major scandal in, I think, 61, when it was exposed by J. William Fulbright, who was also the same senator who later attacked Samuel Maddox and Project Camelot in 1965. He, in fact, entered a whole congressional record in this. But among other things, they had also tried to link some of the efforts that Edwin Walker, General Edwin Walker, was doing using John Birch Society literature to indoctrinate troops in Berlin as part of some of the psychological operations the National Security Council and the Institute were pushing through this. So, anyway, to make a long story short here, this, to my mind, is very much what Kubrick is parroting in Dr. Strangelove, with the, pieces our profession and the obsession General Ripper, who is partly based on Walker, has with fluoride and the water and his precious bodily fluids. This really does seem to indicate some concerns on the part of the Kennedy administration that some of the psychological operations the military was doing to themselves had been so effective that they had maybe bought a little too far into it. And certainly in Dr. Strangelove, you're essentially confronted with a image of the United States military more or less driven insane by its own psychological operations, which is doubly fascinating when you take into context that Strangelove itself is a propaganda film being pushed probably by the Kennedy administration, aspects of the State Department, and probably elements of the CIA against conflicting propaganda initiatives by the Pentagon. So the pullback, this to me is what I find, one of the things, at least I should say, I find to be so fascinating about Kubrick. It's not just that he was a psychological operations officer to some extent or other, but he really seems to have been engaged in some significant struggles in the 60s and probably in the 70s with the different factions of the national security state, which I think is a testament to the quality, if nothing else, of what he was doing. And I think that this also relates to his decision to never return to the United States. Of course, he departed in 1968 and never set foot in this country again, which incidentally was the year that Robert Kennedy was also assassinated in.
And I wonder if you considered in this, with this deep background, that Dr. Strangelove, I believe, was supposed to be released on November 22nd, 1963, but then wasn't released because something else happened. So, I mean,
Well,
it's
see, and it's also interesting because the Pentagon was obsessed with launching a preemptive nuclear strike at the end of 1963. So, even assuming if Kennedy didn't get assassinated, the movie would have come out right at that time frame where possibly they might have been trying to launch a false flag. In fact, this is one of the things I get into in my book, The Art, but I actually think that later they kind of recycled this operation in Vietnam with the Gulf of Tonkin incident, and were hoping to essentially escalate that into a nuclear confrontation with China, which didn't quite work out. But yeah, it's really interesting in the context of a lot of the geopolitics playing out there to the purposes that Strangelove might have been put towards.
Yeah, well, so this is a massively deep background that you've just laid out in the last 15 minutes. And needless to say, I don't explore that in the book or in any of my books. I find it very difficult to get my head around when we're trying to really think about or talk about geopolitics. I think I at least get lost cognitively very quickly, and certainly morally, like it just becomes impossible to really distinguish good from bad when you're operating at that level. And I would say that that's one of the main dangers of being involved in at that level. Kubrick himself put it, don't get too close to power, is you lose your moral compass. I think you have to. So that's where I try and ground it for myself. To me, it doesn't really make much difference which side Kubrick was on, that both sides are up to no good, because that's the nature of the war. But I think it is, I mean, what I extract from all this on a more general level is it's something that very few of us, even the conspiratorially minded researchers, really are able to factor in or map is this it's generally framed as a conspiracy and a war of the elite against the masses. That's generally how it's framed, and I don't think that's wrong, but it's definitely incomplete, because the do I think you and I have touched on this before, the do seem to be consistently within that larger war of elite versus mass. There seem to be these warring factions, which they have more in common with each other than they do with the masses that they're trying to control, but and propagandize, but they disagree, like, you know, with the ways they want to do it. And of course, they want dominion over the conquered lands and the conquered masses once it's achieved. And that, so that element of warring factions is something that, kind of by definition, we it's very hard to even speculate about as compared to the war of the elite against the masses, because at least we're part of the masses. At least we can see the way that war has been waged against our own psyches by looking at our psyches. But this landscape you're talking about, I find it's utterly confounding. I think something with Kubrick and Anonymous that you said we might get into is a similar kind of thing, like who were Anonymous, who were behind them, what kind of you know, hidden war was going on there, a different period in history, and perhaps not as, you know, potentially catastrophic as the one you're referring to. But likewise, it's almost impossible to really to know, you know, who's on which side. When, I mean, people probably switch sides. It's not necessarily even sides in terms of groups and individuals. It's more like agendas. And then if you pull far enough back, how can we be sure that these two apparently warring factions aren't working together, just as Democrats and Republics? If you pull far enough back, you've actually got puppet masters, if you like, that have got one hand in each party. So I don't rule that out either. But I'm saying, how can you really be sure? So to yeah, when I try and narrow this down back to Kubrick himself, it's all very interesting. But to me, how I would kind of sum it up in my own mind is he did get too close to power. He might have felt, like many operatives, that he had the best intentions, the best motives, and believed in what he was doing. But that doesn't mean that he wasn't being played and manipulated. And possibly at a certain point he realized it, or possibly not. I mean, to me, the evidence suggests he was always a player to the very end, and perhaps believed in that you have to pick a side in terms of these warring factions. And I mean, you can't work, I would say. You can't work within the military industrial entertainment industry if you haven't, if you're not useful to at least one side, I think. You're muted. Yeah, you're still muted.
Yeah, sorry, I had to go pay the guy bringing me wood here for a second. All right, I had a train of thought here that I was getting to. Well, anyway, we'll get into this probably more. I think though it's also a bit important though to bring this up in terms of maybe some of the Kubrick psychology though, as we'll get into here in a little bit. But it's interesting you say that. I think it was Michael Hare who made the comment that seems to have been echoed by several of Kubrick's other associates on various biographies I read of the man. And that was that Kubrick played the game, but not as well, quite as well as he thought that he did. And I think that that was very true. Well, anyway, let's get into the moon landing here. I really appreciated your more nuanced take on the subject. So can you break that down for us?
Well, I can. I think it might require some context in terms of what the Kubricon is, but let's see. Because my idea is essentially. Well, if I kind of lead with a serious intended joke, which is any idiot can see that Kubrick didn't fake the moon landing because it looks too damn crappy. And Kubrick would have done a much better job, as we can see from 2001. So then what is it? You know, how did this rumor get started that he did? Well, my hypothesis is that he was involved at some level. Maybe he was even approached, certainly to the extent that he was aware that this was going on, and parallel with 2001, A Space Odyssey. Maybe he was consulted and so on. But he wasn't involved directly, as my thesis, and wouldn't have wanted to be, which is what his own daughter says. So I can at least agree with her on that, Vivian Kubrick. But he was fascinated by the idea, or he did see value in the idea of creating what we now know as a meme, not in the sense of an image online, but you know, in the Richard Dawkins sense of an idea that went viral, that he did do it. So there began a process at some point in Kubrick's oeuvre that becomes most obvious in The Shining, as Jay Widener gets busy trying to prove, where he started planting clues and indications to suggest that he was involved with that fakery. As far as the motives why he would do that, maybe I'll just pause there because I don't know if it'll be necessary to go into the why completely, but that's where the whole Kubrickon thesis comes into it. But the short answer is that Kubrick was, I think, consciously involved in cementing his own legend as a filmmaker artist, much more than average, because you could say that most filmmaker artists do have egos and want to become legendary, but I'd say much more than usual and much more consciously and strategically. And part of that, or connected to that, he wanted his films to generate obsession. So this idea that he faked the moon landing many years later, and even after he died only, it has become another source of obsession for a different generation of Kubrick heads. It mythologizes Kubrick.
Yeah, I think that's really valid. And as to why, see, I actually think that Kubrick might have deliberately spurred some of the moon landing connections himself deliberately. It does seem like that he went to a lot of lengths to build up his mystique. And certainly I do think that he might have been consulted indirectly as to how the moon landing could have been staged, which also may have been one of the reasons why he put references to it throughout several of his films. I think partly maybe because of the megalomania, he was a little irked with not having some degree of credit for it, or actually probably more likely for not being paid for his work on it. But I also wanted to get into the notion of Kubrick also as having total control as well, which is something that really, as a result of specifically also his involvement in the moon landing hoax, which is something that the more I've looked at, it just really doesn't hold up on close analysis. He did have almost total control over his films, I should clarify, but not necessarily on the films that he could make.
Well, that does sort of square the circle, because it's an interesting contradiction for, at least for my thesis. Because on the one hand, I'm saying, look, let's look at this total control that he supposedly had, and unprecedented for any filmmaker before or since. How did he get it? So presenting that as potentially evidence that Kubrick was useful to agendas in an unusual way or to degree. But then on the other hand, part of my thesis is that he was an asset and an instrument of larger agendas. So he couldn't possibly have that much freedom, because then he wouldn't have to cooperate. So that apparently they do seem like they cancel each other out potentially. But I think that you nailed it essentially. He was given an unprecedented amount of freedom when it came to budget, and it didn't matter whether his movies made money or not, which is really unusual. I mean, they have this thing in Hollywood, you're only as good as your last film. Well, that didn't matter to Kubrick, at least as long as you add the element that even when his films tanked at the box office and were reviled by critics, they were reevaluated very quickly. Well, more and more quickly, let's say, or at least over several years, they did eventually become reevaluated by I would say, a deliberate effort of kind of canonization. So he did eventually become, those films did eventually become seen as prestigious for the studios, but that's kind of part of the whole thing that I'm looking at. Essentially, Kubrick didn't have whatever kind of power and freedom he had to make his movies the way he wanted to make them. It wasn't a result of the usual criteria in Hollywood, which is, well, we can count on this guy to at least make his money back, kind of thing. It was based more on his reputation as a great filmmaker. And I think how long it took him to choose a project, this is speculative, but it could well have to do with this, the fact that he could do anything he wanted as long as it was approved, right? So it had to fit, it had to serve as an instrument for the program that he was part of, let's say. And so maybe he would go through, well, we'd know that he went through dozens and dozens of projects before he settled on one. Why? We don't exactly know. There's just that general idea of Kubrick that he took a long time making up his mind, and maybe so, but it's reasonable to suggest a counter hypothesis consistent with this idea that he actually was beholden to other factions.
Well, also, it seems that he actually was much more beholden to the box office than a lot of people have been led to believe. And I also think that this was something that, again, Kubrick tried to cover up along with elements within Warner Brothers to add to his mystique. But let me just sort of get into his journey behind films here, starting with 2001 and going up through The Shining. So the first thing with 2001, you have to sort of emphasize here at the beginning is that it was a huge financial risk for MGM when it took it upon it, it took up the production of it. I don't think it was actually the most expensive movie that was ever made, but it was very close to it. And the expense, especially with the marketing to it, was to the extent that MGM's future was effectively on the line with this movie. And this led to quite a bit of power struggles with him in GM throughout the production. So I'm going to quote from page 157, and Stanley Kubrick produces by James Fenwick here, because I think it gives a great illustration of what was playing out at MGM during the making of 2001. So prior to the purchase of the shares, Kubrick, these are purchases in MGM, by the way, Kubrick had been an initiator of a series of adverts supporting MGM's management, specifically Robert O'Brien, who was involved in a power struggle with Philip Levin, an MGM majority stakeholder since February 1965. Levin wanted to remove O'Brien as CEO. This led Kubrick to persuade 63 other producers and directors, including John Frankenheimer, the guy we just mentioned before, and David Lean, to sign an advert that was placed in Variety, New York Times, and the Wall Street Journal in January 1967. The advert stated that O'Brien was oriented towards a much quality in filmmaking as it consists with commercialism. Kubrick was motivated to take out the advert to support for O'Brien because he believed something should be done in the current situation to demonstrate the esteem in which O'Brien is held by creative people who have worked with him. However, it was likely that Kubrick was also motivated by a desire to protect his interests, including his control as a producer and the ongoing production of 2001. After all, MGM retained a 50% share in 2001, along with perpetual distribution rights. There would be uncertainty as to what would happen to Kubrick and 2001 should the company be taken over and O'Brien removed as CEO. Levin was infuriated by Kubrick's advert and made a complaint to the Securities and Exchange Commission. So Kubrick actually got slapped by the SEC over this. Now, Levin was ultimately not granted the injunction he wanted on the adverts, nor the success in his efforts to usurp O'Brien. O'Brien was later forced to resign in January 1969. He was victorious in his efforts in the shareholders' vote and elected his desired candidates to the boards of directors. By July 1968, Kirk Kervanian, a private investor, had initiated an aggressive takeover of MGM. And this also effectively led to Kubrick leaving the studio. So to put this in perspective, Kubrick makes 2001. It becomes one of the most successful movies ever made. It should have, made him virtually untouchable at that point in time. And yet he is not able to get his long desired project of Napoleon made. And on top of that, his buddy Richard O'Brien here, the guy I just mentioned, who was the major supporter and protector for Kubrick in 2001 at his time heading MGM, was fired essentially in January 1969. So also they've done this great movie and the guy who backed it lost his job over it. Again, this essentially related to them putting the long-term essential existence of MGM on the line with this movie.
Do you
So
have any ideas? Because this is new to me, this part, this information. Do you have any ideas about how it relates to what I cover in the Kubricon in terms of 2001 being promoted very early on before it was finished, with its ties to NASA and as a form of advertising for space travel and in order to, generate investors in the whole industry of space travel?
Well, I do actually. Well, I'll say the film, the documentary that you referenced in KuberCon, I believe, about 2001, that was actually partly made by or greenlit by Kubrick to be made to help support O'Brien and his shareholders thing. So it was partly propagandistic for the shareholders of MGM to be like, look, we're doing this great thing. But I also think that, this again goes back to Kubrick's use as a psychological operations officer against the Pentagon. Because getting back to the American space program, originally it was the military that ran it. In fact, this is why ARPA, which later became DARPA, was created in the first place. We kind of forget this now, but it was actually supposed to be the agency that was going to develop the rockets that would take us to space. And then around 1958, all of this was transferred to NASA. And this was a big deal. The military was very pissed off about this, if for no other reason that it deprived them of billions and billions of dollars that they could dole out to the private sector. And this was still an ongoing dispute throughout the 1960s. So again, I think this goes back partly to clashes between, say, the State Department, who seemed to have been supporting Kubrick in this through the, what was it, the U.S. Information Agency, versus the Pentagon over effectively who was going to get to dole out the funding for space exploration. So I do think you're correct in that sense that it was a propaganda film, partly for NASA, but also partly to help O'Brien keep his job at MGM as well. And also, I think that this might have been another factor too as to why Kubrick left the country after 68, because not only was RFK assassinated, but the Democrats were out of office and the Nixon administration came into power as well. So anyway, Kubrick is not able to get his beloved Napoleon project made. And he comes back with his next movie, A Clockwork Orange. And this actually seems to have been the movie much more so than 2001 that really made his reputation in the industry. And this seems to have been partly due to how Kubrick was able to react to developments in Hollywood as a result of Easy Rider. Because Kubrick basically seems to have been using the Burt Schneider formula with Clockwork. And to like break that down for you guys. So Schneider was the main guy with BBS, along with Bob Rafelson and the Steve Blaum guy, I think, who did Easy Rider, Five Easy Pieces. Basically, this was the production studio that brought all of the counterculture, mystique, and what have you into Hollywood. And Easy Rider was a big deal in the industry because effectively they had taken this low budget Jern picture, because basically it's just a biker movie if you really want to get down to it. And they had spliced in all these, counterculture aesthetics, and obviously with the lacks of censorship, they were able to get nudity and all this other good stuff. And it became a huge, huge, huge hit. In fact, I think to this day, adjusted for inflation, it's still one of the most successful movies ever made. So Kubrick had been toying with the ideal, because again, also the biker genre is essentially a broader or a subsection of the exploitation films in the United States, right? So Kubrick had been toying with the ideal of doing an exploitation film, I think since at least Dr. Strangelove. This is partly where the whole Blue Movie thing with Terry Southers came about, right? And of course, Terry Southern was a part of that whole milieu around Easy Rider. So I think when Kubrick decided to follow up 2001 with Clockwork Orange, basically this is Kubrick doing, by his standards, a low budget exploitation movie. And indeed, the budget for Clockwork Orange, I think, was only like 1.5 million, maybe 2, which was decent in that era, but it's still way below what he had on pretty much all of his other films in around that time frame. And my understanding is most of the budget actually went to acquire the rights to the book on the one hand, and then on the other hand, to pay Malcolm McDowell. A lot of in fact, it's actually theorized this is the reason why Burgess wasn't hired to co-write the script with Kubrick for the film, because Kubrick basically couldn't afford to do it. But anyway, he's essentially following the Burt Schneider formula here. He's doing a exploitation film, in this case, a juvenile delinquent movie, which is another in the United States big thing with biker movies and all that kind of stuff going back to the 1950s. He's bringing in this counterculture aesthetic to it. He's using all the nudity and stuff in it, and he's doing it on a fairly small budget. And in that context, it becomes a huge success. It's made for about $2 million. It grosses over 30 million or something like that at the box office, which is half of, I think, what 2001 had made by 1980. But on the flip side of the coin, 2001 cost 4 or 5 times as much money to make as A Clockwork Orange did, and say nothing of all the advertisement that had to be used to make 2001 a huge hit. So that, by for Kubrick, was the real feather in his cap. He had shown that he could do an exploitation like this, and it's also, I think, the last film he did as well that came in on time and on budget. In fact, I think it might be about the only film that he made. But the point being, it was a huge success. It was very low risk for Warner Brothers, And it showed that he was able to do a movie on a limited budget for, on a schedule and all that other good stuff. And that really, I think, laid the ground for him to do Barry Lyndon. But it's interesting, and this is a point we'll return to. Barry Lyndon was not the movie that Warner Brothers wanted him to make to follow up A Clockwork Orange. Of course, Kubrick wanted to do Napoleon, but Warner Brothers wanted Kubrick to make The Exorcist. And there's a lot of rumors as to why Kubrick passed on that, but he didn't end up making it. And they seem to have finally come to a compromise that Kubrick could make Barry Lyndon. So originally it was budgeted at $2.5 million. And of course, famously, it went way over budget, over production. It was a huge flop. And that kind of gets us to The Shining. We talked about this in email exchanges. I really don't think that Kubrick liked The Shining. As I've been looking at this more, he was actually given a promo copy of it before it was even released by Warner Brothers. And while I don't think either Warner Brothers or Kubrick would ever acknowledge this, I really think Kubrick had to make The Shining essentially as an apology to Warner Brothers for passing on The Exorcist and making Barry Lyndon. Let's see here. Well, let's get into The Shining a little bit, or excuse me, The Clockwork Orange a little bit more here. So some of the links that this movie had to violence I thought were a little tenuous, such as the connection it had to the attempted assassination of George Wallace, for instance. Arguably Taxi Driver was more central to the attempted Reagan assassination. And of course, you have all the presence of Catcher in the Rye with so many numerous would-be assassins and actual assassins. But with Clockwork Orange, what's really interesting to me about the violence attributed to it is that it almost entirely happened in the UK, and it occurred during its initial run from 72 to 74. And what's more, many filmgoers in the UK saw it at one specific theater during that era, which was the Warner West East Cinema. Over 55,000 people saw it there, where it grossed over £400,000. So apparently, distribution was mostly limited outside of London. So, Jason, what do you make of that?
Well, I'd have to speculate, but it is significant. I mean, first of all, of course, we don't know for sure, like if the reporting represents the reality. All we know for sure then is that the incidents of copycat violence, alleged to happen as a response to Clockwork Orange were mostly or entirely in Britain, where Kubrick already lived by that point, correct?
Yes,
So,
sir. You've been living there since the
yeah.
beginning.
So it was particularly disturbing for Kubrick, obviously, and hence led to him withdrawing the film or refusing to have it shown again. I mean, I would have to, my mind can only go to the possibility that the Clockwork Orange, as a an artifact of mind control, which, as I said earlier, every movie is attempting to mind control to the extent it's trying to alter moods and trigger reactions and so on, but with that qualifier, like a much more amped up kind of mind control that was designed to provoke violence, let's say, in viewers, that it wasn't sufficient just to expose them to the movie, and therefore they had other things going on. I mean, but I say that's highly speculative, but it's probably worth speculating. And but then that raises the question of, how much was the copycat violence caused by Clockwork Orange allegedly a psyop on Kubrick? And that has to be considered also. So I don't know what you have to say, because I presume you have your own theories. Muted.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Well, let's get back here to The Exorcist for a second, where I think that this is interesting because obviously there were a lot of reported colorful audience reactions to the film, and specifically in some accounts, audiences were said to, be vomiting, fainting, just all kinds of incredible stuff like that. Now, this is something Chris Knowles has looked into a lot, and he found out that These incidences were only actually happening in certain theaters. It wasn't, but at all like across the boards phenomena. It was only a few theaters where audiences really seemed to be having these extreme reactions. And that had led Chris to speculating that maybe some kind of psychotronics were being used in certain theaters with The Exorcist. So getting back to, what I was just saying before about The Exorcist and Kubrick, this is where this gets to be really interesting because Clockwork Orange and Exorcist, they're both Warner Brothers movies. Kubrick makes Clockwork Orange, and then Warner's really wants him to follow it up with The Exorcist. And in the case of both films, they seem to have a lot of these incidences of really adverse audience reactions, but really stemming from really just specific theaters, if you will. So I can't help but wonder if maybe Chris is on to something about The Exorcist and it was part of a broader operation unfolding in both the US and the UK during this time frame.
Well, I mean, I suppose, again, speculating that if there was a goal to be able to create movies that would have specific effects, psychosomatic effects, they might find that it wasn't working and they have to help it along a little bit while they're perfecting the art. So one question would be, does that still go on, or was that just part of trial and error whereby they managed to get films to have a psychotronic effect without having to actually, wire the seats or whatever else, which of course they literally did for William Castle's The Tingler. But who knows, how what kind of things they've done covertly and how much of that is experimental in terms of, well, if we've got these extra things in a theater, we can boost the effects of a movie and therefore observe them better rather than it being, because essentially they don't want to have to rig out every theater with psychotropic machinery, I presume. They want to actually perfect the art of psychotropic warfare with the movies themselves. But yeah, it's very speculative, but I would speculate, and that they have. I mean, that this was a phase where they were experimenting with the power of cinema to cause visceral reactions, which overlaps, with exploitation movies, as you pointed out with The Clockwork Orange. That, and this is again, it's a blurry line where I'd say if we're going to try and evaluate what Kubrick was doing morally, because I think we should. I don't think we should leave out the moral question. There isn't a clear dividing line between a psychological operation that's trying to traumatize populations and thereby condition them, and exploitation cinema that's done cynically as a way to make money via the same effects. It's just that one is more consciously malevolent, where the other is just irresponsible and selfish, you could say. So I mean, I would question why Kubrick would do that anyway. Why would he choose to make an exploitation movie except to try and up his game so that he could make what he wanted to make? That seems quite irresponsible for somebody who's that aware. Interesting, that was how Pauline Kael, who the critic for The New Yorker, who despised Clockwork Orange, as did I, admittedly, I read her review before I ever saw it. That was one of the ways she framed it, that Kubrick had cynically catered to the new audiences who were hungry for sex and violence. Like he didn't want to be caught lagging, he didn't want to be behind the game. And I think there's something in that, as well as what you're speculating, that he wanted to see if he could do an exploitation movie, just as he was curious about doing a pornography movie, partly in order to beef up his power in Hollywood to do future projects. But yeah, all of that is, as I say, it's consistent with a darker and more covert agenda, which is exploitation well beyond the cinema. It's like exploitation cinema, at least there's a kind of agreement from the audience where, yeah, we're going to pay our money to be exploited and we're going to like it. It may still be harmful, I think it usually is, but at least they know, you know, they're paying for what they get. Whereas Clockwork Orange and these more sophisticated, Exorcist also was very well reviewed. It's considered a classic. I think it's a terrible movie, but it's a very efficient movie because it has these visceral effects. And that, if that passes for, you know, a classic or for art, that opens it up to much wider target audiences. Like people even took their kids to The Exorcist, I read in Pauline Kael's review, because they could, because it was an R, and because it's Warner Brothers, it's prestigious, then they will. They would never take their kids to a Roger Corman movie. But also when they're there, they're open in a different way. We were touching on this before about the difference between open occult kind of artwork and more disguised occult symbolism and stuff. This is not the same, but it's similar, that audiences are more open psychically, or they're open in a different way. Anyway, I'd say more open if they think they're in the presence of a mainstream work that's a classic by a, you know, Oscar-winning filmmaker, in the case of William Friedkin and you know, Kubrick, this great genius. That does not just not only does it reach a much larger demographic, but it also reaches people at a higher or a deeper level because of what, you know, what they think that they're getting, and also the way they will judge it or reject it afterwards. They might, if it had Roger Corman's name on it, The Exorcist would, it wouldn't have been reviewed the way it was, and audiences wouldn't have come away kind of rationalizing that it was a disgusting movie full of these abhorrent images that were basically just purely exploitative. They would have just rejected it as that. But because it's getting all these reviews, and then they will reconfigure their own consciousness and say, well, you know, a little girl masturbating with a crucifix, he was making a point, you know, it was a serious movie. So it's good that he had that freedom, right? That's reconfiguring the whole of society little by little. And it's very well, we've seen, I don't want to oversimplify, I was going to say we've seen where it's got us, but that's what old fogies say. But we have seen that permissiveness in society can go way too far, right? Like we've definitely got to the point where you have to be completely woke, quote unquote, to not acknowledge that we need some moral checks and bounds, and that there is a case to be made for censorship. I never thought I would say it. I mean, I don't actually make a case, because I don't think you can ask the institutions and organizations that are making the shit to censor it. But I mean, there's a case to be made for discernment and just say this is not healthy. So anyway, that was a lot of stuff in response in terms of Clockwork Orange. Like I think at a number of different levels, it works as a as an attack on the human psyche and on the community. I don't think it passes for art. There are Kubrick movies where I can say, okay, that has a benign quality, like Barry Lyndon, even The Shining. But Clockwork Orange to me is the most starkly pernicious Kubrick movie. I actually don't see any good in that as a movie at all.
Yeah, it's and like I said, the impression I've gotten is this was the movie more than 2001 that made his reputation in the industry. So I do kind of feel that Kubrick was deliberately this wasn't a passion project for him. He had a specific target audience in mind within like the studio hierarchy here, I think, to sort of prove a point in terms of what he could make. On the flip side of the coin, though, too, I have to wonder if Kubrick was aware, let's just say hypothetically, if there was some kind of psychotronics being used in the film, if he actually signed off on that. Because again, you know, this is also part of a much broader geopolitical context in the UK. As I'm sure you're aware, there was a lot of speculation that there were effectively soft coups against first the administration of Edward Heath and then later Harold Wilson in 74 and 75, I think. So there's a lot of intrigues related to that playing out at this point in time, as well as the heightened troubles in Northern Ireland after the Sunday Bloody Sunday massacres. And it also just so happened that in 1973, Stanley Kubrick was filming his last movie extensively on location, Barry Lyndon. And where was he filming that? He was filming it in Ireland, around the time the troubles were going, in which in Northern Ireland, a psychological warfare officer named Colin Wallace was running what was referred to as Operation Clockwork Orange. So I think there was a lot going on with all of this. It's still something I'm trying to totally sort out, but I do think that there was some significant intrigues that went in behind the production of both Clockwork Orange and Barry Lyndon.
Well, yeah, go ahead.
Well, do you want to get into The Shining now? I thought your take on that was absolutely stellar. Do you want to break that down for us?
Which part of it? What specifically?
Well, I was thinking really your sort of interpretation on it, the whole thing with the maze, the cycle of abuse, all the other stuff like that. And I mean, also maybe in some ways being almost a metaphor for Kubrick's own relationship with his family.
Right. Well, certainly I go into The Shining more than any other movies, I think. I talk a lot about Eyes Wide Shut because I find it so compelling as a movie, but and because of the content, the story content. But The Shining is the only Kubrick movie really after Doctor Strangelove that I find I can connect to put it in sort of neutral terms, that I really think has qualities as a movie, as a dramatic movie. It moves me and it engages me, and so I was willing to spend more time on it. But then, of course, there's Room 237, which is the main reason why I gave The Shining the time to really find a way to connect to it, because I'd seen it many times, simply because I kept thinking there must be something good about this movie because everybody's saying it's good, and I like the book and I like the subject matter. It always felt like a movie I should like, because I mean, what could be more compelling than watching a writer go crazy in a mansion over winter, right? It's just inherently fascinating, or should be. So I did keep trying to watch it, but I never really liked it until I'd seen Room 237, and I found that much more enjoyable than I'd found The Shining. I found it fascinating, and so it did help me with an in to shine, get an in to The Shining, and then when I was writing and thinking and writing about it, what I ended up doing was making a unified, that's called the guts, isn't it? The grand unified theory of The Shining, the guts of The Shining, whereby all of those interpretations in Room 237 can be seen as valid, not literally valid in the case of the moon landing, say. Although, as we've touched on today, it's valid enough if you allow that Kubrick intentionally made it seem like he had faked the moon landing. And not necessarily literally valid in the sense that he intentionally wanted to make a metaphor about any of these other things, such as the Indian American genocide or the Holocaust, but rather that he was, well, two things I think were going on. One of them conscious and the other perhaps unconscious. One was, I think, that Kubrick did want to make a movie, and maybe all of his movies, he had this idea of making a kind of fractal movie that was a holographic fragment of everything. I mean, every ambitious artist has this kind of goal of, can they encapsulate the meaning of life in their work? And it's obviously by definition impossible. You can't encapsulate the infinite, much less go beyond it. So nonetheless, so Kubrick, wanting to do that isn't necessarily that unusual, but that he maybe approached consciously, like, ha this would go against your theory that he didn't want to do The Shining unless he just somehow managed to make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. But he, let's just say anyway, my theory that he was trying to find a story, or he hit upon The Shining as a possible story, that was sufficiently archetypal that it would serve as this kind of fractal artifact. And this would relate to the Golden Bough, actually, although I don't include that in my thesis, but the golden bow is the source, I think, of the killing of the king, this idea of the killing of the king ritual, not that it's the source of it, but I mean, it's what made it so well known in the West, in the modern West. And that's very much embedded in the story of The Shining, because it's an inversion of it. It's about a father who wants to kill his son, which is Saturn, the myth of Saturn. Like Saturn wants to castrate his sons so they won't grow up to replace him. And that within that, there's an archetypal resonance, which is essentially the war between fathers and sons. Like you can take either side in the myths. You can see that there are myths like the Lucifer myth, in which the son rises up against the father, and then you can see the Saturn myth, where it's the father oppressing the son. And you can even look at the Lucifer myth from the other side and say that Lucifer was oppressed by his father, and so on, right there. They're just two sides of the same coin, and they're clearly archetypal because they're clearly universal. Like every father, every man who has a son experiences some sort of rivalry with that son. He knows biologically that he's created his own replacement, and by definition, every son has to overcome or get free of the influence of the father in order to embody the father. He has to replace the father, which is effectively killing the father. So that can play out at the most profound or the most traumatic level in terms of actual violence. And clearly that's what The Shining is about. Danny's too young to really, standing like he wants to kill his father. Danny's got his own thing going on with that split in his psyche, which is part of the whole thing that The Shining is exploring. Anyway, so the I looked at Room 237 and the way in which all of those myths to varying degrees are to do with paternal abuse. So you got the US government making Kubrick, or maybe not making him, but recruiting him to fake a moon landing and then having control. That's a betrayal in itself, you could say. It's roping him into some sort of shady agenda, making him compromise himself. And so the US government standing in for the father and Kubrick for the son, the Holocaust, the genocide, all of these things are about abuse of power. Even the John Fell Ryan talks about being a father, and how he's losing touch with his function and role as a father. The Maze is about the Minotaur, which is the illegitimate son of an unholy union. It's in there. Obviously, I can't remember all the things I tease out, but I definitely found all kinds of compelling evidence for this first layer, which is that Kubrick was consciously trying to design a movie that would represent some recurring, eternally recurring pattern within the male human psyche, to represent a sort of principle in the universe. And of course, that's in The Shining itself. Like, he's always been the caretaker. It's constantly repeating, because that's just, well, it's not necessarily the way things are, but it's something that we've got caught in since the original trauma or the original wound, and so it keeps repeating until it will resolve itself. But taken to the cosmic dimension as well, as I say, with the archetypes of Lucifer and Saturn and etc. And then at the perhaps the unconscious level, I would say we have Kubrick's own struggle to resolve the tension in his own psyche, both as a father who potentially is not being the best man he could be to his children, whatever's going on there. I don't even try to speculate there, but we can easily assume that he did have some issues as a father. He wasn't a perfect father, and as the, well, a literal son, but I don't speculate there either, what his relationship was like with his father. There is evidence, if we look at fathers throughout his oeuvre, there's some evidence, I think, that he had father issues. But more symbolically, in terms of him being under the power of something that he was trying to get free of, whether it's God, whether it's the demiurge, Which I point out, Jack Torrance is a kind of like a demiurge in the Overlook in certain ways. When we see him looking down at the maze, and we see his wife and child in the maze, and that's a stand-in for Kubrick, who is like the demiurge when he's making his movies and having total control or trying to have total control. But he's also that he's got that obsession because he himself feels like he's also trapped inside this maze. As well as the cosmic dimensions, then the whatever powers that Kubrick was under, the worldly powers, whether the government or intelligence or military or things that we've been speculating about here, I think at some level he was wrestling with that more unconscious splinter in his brain, if you will. With The Shining than with other works, because I just find that it has more resonance, both archetypally and emotionally. To me, there's more an emotional center in The Shining than in his other films. I think he tried not to get it in, because I think Kubrick did try not to give his films an emotional center for reasons that we probably won't get into today, but has to do with the Kubrickon thesis. But I think with The Shining, he couldn't help himself. That somehow, so it would be very interesting if you're right and he had never wanted to do the book, because that might even be part of what happened, is that he somehow, because he couldn't choose the project, he ended up doing something that he couldn't protect himself from identifying with and got pulled into some kind of process that he managed to avoid with his other works, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think the whole all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy was almost partly like his kind of depiction of the work, like writing process on this, because it just, I don't think that he was at all interested in the novel. And it's fascinating too, because after Paths of Glory, of course, I think all of his movies were based on a novel to some degree or other, but after Paths of Glory, he worked with the novelists that had written the novels that he was adapting. I think in every case, with the exception of Clockwork Orange, and as I said before, I think that was because he actually just couldn't afford to hire Burgess, but he still seems to have been in regular contact with Burgess throughout the writing process to try to get unpaid advice from him. He didn't work with the novelist in the case of Barry Lyndon or Eyes Wide Shut, in that case most likely because they were dead. And even in the case of like Dr. Strangelove and Full Metal Jacket, he even worked with the novelist to some degree, whereas with King, I think he had like one or two conversations with him and then never really had any communications with him after that. And a lot of things, I mean, I know the reason why they added the maze, which is different from the novel, is because in theory, they were supposed to have these like what, these hedge animals that would chase them around or something like that, and the animatronics weren't advanced enough or something to that effect to make it look realistic, which, could very well be the case, but I also just think Kubrick wanted to change it for the purposes of turning into more of this Jungian kind of psychoanalysis that you're getting at.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Do you have any more thoughts on that?
Oh, well, the maze is absolutely essential. It's something you can't imagine Kubrick's The Shining without the maze. So I very much doubt that that's the reason. I can't see Kubrick ever agreeing to shoot scenes of animated hedge animals, right? Yeah, he really tried not to ever jump the shark. I think the only time he did was Eyes Wide Shut, and that was in a very different way. But yeah, I think that's probably the cover story. It's interesting. I mean, as a detail here that supports what you're talking about and what I hypothesize too, the image that I include in the Kubrickon of the on the set of The Shining, where there's a sign that says definitely no smoking, and then there's an object obscuring the first three letters of smoking, so it just says definitely no King. That to me is a smoking gun in two ways. One, that Kubrick absolutely was divorcing his film from the novel, and two, that he had an eye for or a penchant for putting clues in all around, and in everything he arranged, he wanted to arrange these hidden messages.
You know, it also, I mean, he always did the sort of subtle clues with the props and stuff in many of his films, but it really seems like it started going into overdrive with The Shining too, and then also possibly that the clues were becoming more and more obscure as well, that opened them up to different interpretations. Did you get maybe that sense?
Yeah, well, that's part of my thesis was that, first of all, you start planting clues that are clearly planted and are clearly there to be interpreted certain ways, such as in 2001, Hal cheating on the chess game. And I can't verify that for myself because I'm not a chess player, but I'm just trusting my sources there that Hal cheats. And obviously, that is a clue you're supposed to find later on repeat viewings and say, oh, okay, Hal was starting to malfunction and or become malevolent at that point, and that was embedded in there. That creates the helps create the idea that Kubrick's films need repeat viewings to look for these subtle details. Then you have clues that are, I would say, intentionally placed, but they're not obviously meaning. They don't have obvious meanings. You can interpret them more than one way, as we see with Room 237. And then I'd say the third layer is you have things that Kubrick didn't plant there, but they're anomalies because the life is full of anomalies, including mistakes such as the chair in The Shining that moves because the lack of continuity. And once you've created, so it's a three-pronged thing. Once you've created the impression, seeded the idea that Kubrick movies have this other layer, and so you get people to start looking, and then you train the way that they look by what they find, and eventually their own process, pareidolia, I think it's called, will start finding things that weren't. Well, they weren't placed there. You could even say they're not really there, like a face in a cloud, but that's entirely subjective, right? If you see a face in the cloud, well, there's a face in the cloud for you. It doesn't mean the cloud actually has a face, but it means something. The interface between your consciousness and the cloud has created a face, indisputably. It's just that maybe no one else will see it. And Room 237 exhibits this. And what I say, what my thesis is that Kubrick was consciously working with that. He was aware of that process, and he wanted his movies to amplify that effect of the symbiotic relationship between human consciousness, between the viewer and the work itself, as a forerunner for the fusion of human consciousness with artificial intelligence, with the technology of internet, which he was aware of with DARPA. So that, well, that's the, we did finally get to it. So we're up to 2 hours now. That's the part, the main part of the Kubrickon thesis, I think, which puts these little clues and anomalies in a wholly different context. Like, it's not just about making the films more interesting, not just about generating this idea that Kubrick's this mastermind who's seeding his works with all this amazing detail. It's actually about a much deeper process, which we can see, as I talk about in the book, from DARPA onward, to Cambridge Analytica, Facebook, all the world of algorithms that we're now lost in. Kubrick was on the cutting edge of that technology, that science, and also that it's a phenomenology. Like, even before it's a science, it's a phenomenon of human consciousness. As many of us are aware, you can't separate the experience from the observer entirely. And so, what happens? How can one manipulate that interface? How can one maximize the potential of it? How can one weaponize it? All of these things, I posit, was Kubrick's end game, specifically because during 2001, he became fascinated, if not obsessed, with the question of artificial intelligence and what would happen when it's generated. And would it actually do what Hal did? Would it try and destroy human beings? And what would be the means to prevent that? And or just how can we make, because artificial intelligence, well, It's a bit of an oxymoron, I say, but certainly if an artificial intelligence calculates that humanity is too much of a margin for error, therefore it has to extinguish or exterminate humanity, you could say that's not really intelligence, that's just mathematical computation. So I'd say there's these two problems that Kubrick is trying to solve that were really one problem: how to create artificial intelligence that actually is intelligent and therefore won't wipe out human beings. That's my hypothesis. I admit it's kind of like science fiction, but I think Kubrick was after a big fish, and that's what I think he was doing, and that's I think what that's one way to look at the way that Kubrick films have impacted society and individuals, and the way they have this long-term, long-lasting effect on human consciousness via the technology, and that it only really started snowballing with the internet, because now we have millions of, well, thousands of people analyzing Kubrick frame by frame, and it's kind of it's gone runaway now. It's like a forest fire of Kubrickophilia.
Well, I think you're largely spot on. You see, as you probably gathered, I really don't think that there's any legitimacy to Kubrick, you know, filming the moon landing or probably even being knowingly involved in perpetuating the moon landing, though I do think that he did continue to enjoy an ongoing relationship with the intelligence services, which did lead to him having a certain amount of control, not over the films that he made, but how he made them. And I think understanding this, a key to it is in his approach to pre-production in his films, which involved just phenomenal amounts of research. I know Jan Fenwick, I believe James Fenwick, when he was going through the Kubrick archives, had stumbled upon, like, I think almost this entire room full of books, which he thought essentially was the whole of Kubrick's personal private collection. And it turned out that these books were actually just for one single project that he had been working on, and he had these kinds of collections for almost every single project. By the 70s, he had a full-blown staff that was working with him as they were going through all of these projects. So it's interesting that I think around 1970 or so is when he first started working on what eventually became the Steven Spielberg movie AI. And he would continue to work on that ongoing for the next 30 years or so, and certainly around the time that he was doing The Shining. But anyway, in researching this project, obviously he was looking at all kinds of fields of cutting-edge science, not just related to AI, but also things related to, say, you know, the future of the climate, I mean, all this other kind of thing, because he was trying to sketch out this whole vision for what the future would be like with this just insane amount of data that he was compiling and going through that. So, to me, this is effectively what an intelligence analyst does for a living. And what's more, when it comes to this specific type of analysis, which would basically be making forecasts on what the future is going to be like, it's a big thing in the intelligence community and the defense establishment as the whole. I mean, the Pentagon has an entire think tank, the Office of Net Assessments, I believe what it's called, that's entirely dedicated to this, trying to make projections about future technology of weapons and stuff like that. And that's hardly the only one. I mean, RAND could also be partly described as doing this. There's a lot of think tanks out there that specialize specifically in futures forecasts about technology, how they're going to impact society, and all this other kind of stuff. So, with Stanley Kubrick, few people would dispute that he was a brilliant man and that he was a meticulous researcher and analysis of an analyzer of that research. So I suspect that at least part of the reason why Kubrick was involved with science fiction throughout his career and continued to research this AI project for decades and decades is because it was a cover for at least part of the work he was doing on the side in effectively intelligence analysis and futures forecasts for one of the, or probably more, the Anglo-American intelligence services or military or whatever. But this seems to have been the most likely explanation for why Kubrick at least had some amount of the financial independence that he had. I suspect that his income, especially when he wasn't making films, seems to have been quite considerable. And it also, I should point out, this is really in contrast of how Hollywood works. I mean, even really big actors and directors are usually adamant about getting their next movie out because that's when they get paid. You know, you might go several years in Hollywood without getting paid, so you're usually broke by the time your next picture is coming out. Kubrick, he never had to worry about that. He always had money. So I'm guessing a lot of that was because he had a nice little at least side gig doing this futures forecasting. Does any of that maybe ring true to you, Jason?
Well, it's good to get your take on it, and throughout this conversation, really, but a lot of it's been just entirely new to me, and stuff I didn't want or need to get in with the Kubrick-on. But in this case, because you've done all of this deep background research, you're somebody who, if you don't just kind of throw out my Kubrick-on thesis with a laugh, makes me feel, oh, well, maybe I did somehow hit on something. Because to be frank, I could never quite believe it while I was writing it, working on it, researching it. But I just kept finding more and more evidence and thinking, well, this is the argument I'm going to make, even though it reads like a science fiction novel itself. So it's good to get your take on it, that based on all the much more time that you spent researching, that it hasn't entirely blown my thesis out of the water. So, yeah, it's good to hear.
Well, fantastic. At least I could help you with that. But did you have anything else here before we wrap up on Kubrick's whole thing with his films potentially being two-way mirrors? Because I thought that was so fascinating, essentially with the viewer's perception influencing them. It's almost like the whole spooky action at a distance or something to that effect.
Yeah, to me that is the core of it. I would suggest that we do wrap up now because I'm actually running out of steam. It's quite late here. We can always do a follow-up if you like, or if we end up talking about Big Mother, there's plenty of overlap there. But yeah, because it's such a deep, dark well that you're mentioning now, I would say that let's leave it for another day.
All right, sir. Well, fair enough. It's been an absolutely great conversation, and I really appreciate you coming on here for me with this. I obviously I'd say we definitely part company in a few aspects of Kubrick, but I'm glad that we can have this respectful and highly intelligent conversation about the man.
Well, we didn't get into a bar fight about the aesthetic qualities of Kubrick, and so maybe another day. I'm not too attached to my critical judgment of Kubrick, to be frank. But yeah, it seems as though there's certainly plenty of overlap. So yeah, I found it very, very useful as well, this conversation.
All right, sir. Thank you so much for coming on. And thank you guys out there so much for listening. With that, I say to you, as always, good night and good luck to you all. All right, I'm finished recording here on my end.
Okay. Well, I guess I'll get going. You'll let me know when it's going to be up. I didn't get to plug my new Substack, but you can always just stick a link there.
Yeah, I'll stick a link in there for you. And yeah, no, definitely we'll have to have you back on here for a follow-up. And yeah, when I finish my presentation too on Kubrick for Strange Realities, I'll send that on to you because I know there's probably be a lot of interesting stuff in there. Yeah, I didn't really get into it a lot, but I also think the whole thing with his ties to the surrealist circles in New York were really, really crucial, and the whole connections with was it Dreams That Money Can Buy? I think the Hans Richter film. There's really some disturbing stuff with that.
Right. So your next book is on its way, it sounds like.
Oh, this is just for a presentation, though. I had kind of thought with all the research I've done, maybe I should do it as like a short book or something. It's half of it's already written anyway, so.